This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Hey, everybody, I'm Dick Beyer. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. Today, we are joined by an eminent member of the lean community and a pioneer in driving value into major public projects. Stuart Ekblad is with us today. Stuart, how are you?
Hey, Dick, I'm fine. In fact, I'm great. It's a Friday afternoon. Looking forward to a relaxing weekend, but I'm great.
Yeah, we should probably have, instead of water, we should probably have a glass of Chardonnay or something in front of us. And then the conversation would really wander off into where it needs to go.
Probably.
So you're currently with the University of California at San Francisco. Tell us a little bit about your current position and what you're up to.
Sure. So my current position is, my title, if that's interesting, is Vice President of Major Capital Projects for UCSF Health. And we're within the real estate group, but my focus is on the inpatient and outpatient facilities for the capital program for the health side of UCSF. And my current project, actually I have two current ones. One is the new hospital at Parnassus Heights, which is a 3.8 and growing billion-dollar hospital project, and then within a $4.5 billion program here at the Parnassus Heights. And that includes a hospital and then renovations and some other construction projects. I have a second project down at Mission Bay, which is it's basically an ambulatory surgery center and clinic. It's there to support. My first part of my career at UCSF was to build what we call the Mission Bay Hospital, which was a 1,000-square-foot, roughly not quite 300-bed hospital. And now the ambulatory surgery center across the street is there to take care of the outpatient side of that campus, as well as provide additional ambulatory surgery, which to improve our ability to provide surgical services. So that's what I'm currently working on. That's my
So it's just small projects here and there. A little $1 billion here and $1 billion there.
I had a couple more in between, but we don't need to talk about those. But yeah, it's I've been very fortunate, to be honest. It's not so much the dollars, but to be entrusted with leading projects of that magnitude within a public health system, or even with a public system, not even a public health, but a public system. Now, the UC system is, of course, quite extensive. So yeah. I'm really honored to have that privilege.
Yeah, it's amazing. So were you are you a San Francisco native? Are you born and bred out there, or how did you where did you grow up?
I just eventually migrated here to California. originally, in a very short term of my life, I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is where my parents are from. But we moved to Pittsburgh when I was about 5 years old. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then through different schools and at different jobs, I worked my way to San Francisco.
And what was your what's your collegiate background? Where did you go to school for?
So my undergraduate degree was Kent State University in Kent, Ohio.
Wow.
5-year architectural program at that time. It was one of the few at that time, because you can tell I didn't just come out of school very recently. It was one of the few schools that was close enough to me that we could afford, that was also accredited in architecture. So it was a great program. And it was one of those schools that they say, if you come here for 5 years, you can get a job anywhere as an architect. And that was true. But they didn't promise I'd stay practicing architecture, but I was well prepared. And then I went to, I got really interested in less about the architecture, but more about how people reacted to architecture. So I got the sort of the psychology of architecture and the environment. So I went to a program at the University of Wisconsin, which was basically an environmental studies program that did that. It just basically, we read a lot of books about how the physical environment affects, you know, your health, how it affects your physiology, kinesiology, those kinds of things. So I spent about 2 years doing that. And that actually, that was a cornerstone for my future going, my career going forward.
That's great. Well, Kent State obviously was prominent in my life. I was a freshman at Middlebury College in 1969 when all that stuff went on at Kent State. So,
yeah, 1964 was a big year. So
it was the Kent State Golden Flashes. Few people know that that's their nickname. It's a good thing to know for trivia.
I should actually check. It's not 1974. It's 1970 that was the big year. So,
yep, there you go. The spring of 1970. So you were up in Wisconsin and then were you working up there as well?
I was just going to graduate school, but to earn my way through, I got lucky, very lucky in the landscape department. They wanted somebody to provide context in architecture to landscape students. So I got to teach students about not just, you know, I don't know that much about landscape, so I wasn't really smart on that side. But what I did know is, like, if you're going to do this, you should understand some of the architecture that you're trying to relate to. And so I spent about a year and a half of doing that. It was really, really fun time to work with the students and start to even get my own feelings about the significance of the different architecture types and how they relate and how you react to them. So it was a great experience.
And then did you start working for an architectural firm or did you go right into the public services?
The inverse. So when I graduated from Kent State, that's when I went and practiced for about a year and a half before I went to Wisconsin. And that was part of that practice that, you know, it was really, as I'm sure every architect student comes out, you know, they think they'll be famous in about a year or two. And so I found that I was really getting a lot of dirty shirts leaning across that graphite pencils. So I said that probably wasn't going to work for me. So, and I wasn't really getting any design experience. And so that's why I decided I think I'll go on to graduate school. But then after, so my thesis at the University of Wisconsin, I got very interested in kinesiology, color, and light. And So my thesis was, could you use color and light to reduce patient recovery time? And my mentor was an elderly gentleman who really understood these different perceptions and sensory perceptions. And so guided me to a full library of books to read. And so I spent 2 years reading and writing. And so my interest was, you know, what happens, you know, like when the heart, when the body sees red light or blue light or green light, what happens physiologically? And of course, it, you know, there's a lot of psychology, so it isn't perfect science, but it really got me interested in healthcare.
Interesting.
And how the environment could really affect healthcare. And so, we'll talk a little bit later, but I'm getting to, I wouldn't say use, but to influence some of the things now in the new Parnassus Hospital, because with like LED lighting, which I didn't have when I did my thesis, is now really creating some tremendous opportunities to influence the patient environment in different ways with color and light. So I went to Kaiser after that, to Kaiser Medical Healthcare Program after that.
Yeah, so I think John Toussaint and those guys were up in Wisconsin thinking about, he wrote the book On the Mend. You remember that book? It's about lean healthcare and stuff. And they talked about a very small kind of Wisconsin medical provider where they were trying out some of these new things. And
I'll have to look for that. I'm not aware of that. So thank you for the reference.
In the 90s, yeah. All right, so you went to Kaiser, which is a big system. I had Kaiser, not permanently, but I had them for a while. And actually, Dan Fauché and I worked on the Kaiser Replacement Hospital in Oakland, which was a big project. And we were up there doing some of the lean stuff in the last planner system on that project with, I think it was McCarthy who built that hospital.
Right. It was McCarthy that did that. Right?
Yeah, and it was an interesting, talk about tight sites. That place was, you couldn't fit a trailer on the back 8 feet of it. So
no, it consumed the entire block. So there was only the sidewalk, basically. I was still there when at Kaiser when they were starting that project.
That was quite a project. So where did you start? Did you start in San Francisco or in the Bay Area?
So when I came to when I finished my thesis, I wrote to Kaiser and said I'm interested in these kinds of things. And so there's a pretty. I'm not sure I should tell this one story, but Dr. Garfield is the founder of Kaiser Permanente, certainly with Henry Kaiser himself. And so when I wrote this letter saying I was interested in research and patient care, and this Department of Operations and Research wrote back to me, which Dr. Garfield was a part of, and he said, so we're trying to figure out on going forward in our building program, what should we be thinking about in terms of the next building, in terms of how do we control our costs? And so they were doing a lot of analytical work between the existing buildings to see, you know, what were the good things that really worked and were there some opportunities to save money? Because that was definitely, the program at that time was still virtually new in that kind of way. So I did have an opportunity to talk to Dr. Garfield, and my thesis was in my thesis. I think I can't remember exactly, but I think the average patient stay was 6.7 days or something, some magic number like that. And so when I went to Dr. Garfield, and I said, so, you know, what do you think about this color and light and reducing patient recovery time? And he said, I think that's a great idea, but I don't know how to reduce it because we're already at 3.5. So so I kind of like had got my hopes down a little bit. And then he said, but you know, love the chat. So because there aren't many architects that understand research. So they kept me, hired me in operations research. And so it was a really great background to understand how motion, timeliness, being the most efficient in terms of seeing care of the patients. So I actually had at that time, I would call it a lean background before it was given that recognition.
Yeah, interesting. So was that throughout their system? That sounds like a service.
That was only at that time, it was Northern California. In fact, I think there was only Northern California and Southern California at that time. I'll be honest, I don't really know, but I think that's, I believe it was only North and South when I started.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, because I was in San Diego when I was using Kaiser. So did you move into project management from that, or how did you get into supervising projects where you...
Yeah, so it's kind of a long journey, but in the time that I was there, because the research project that I actually hired to do, they ended up with so much data, they weren't sure what to do with it. So we never did figure out the building type that mattered, but I had the chance to create some, because we were one of the few that had computers at that time. So I built a computer-based space programming model, and it was pretty sophisticated. So you basically say the services or the docs you wanted or whatever, and then it would spit out us. And so we could do these overnight. So that's sort of how, you know, that got me sort of part of what I learned in life is from Kaiser and from others is, you know, I often kid about this, Kaiser's dump trucks or cement trucks had a slogan on the side, find a need and fill it. And so that was sort of what happened. The Kaiser was like, well, we don't know exactly what to do with you, but you know, you're doing some interesting things. So now what do you think about moving into the design side, because you're an architect? And so I moved from programming to the design side, and then got responsible for the design and construction for the Northern California campuses.
Okay.
And then so I'm not sure where you want to go with this exactly, but what really made a difference, which is where actually my career, what I'd call one of the turning points was part of my responsibility was one of these medical hospital in Santa Rosa that was a design build project, and it was way behind schedule. And so I went up there and ended up actually moving, not literally, but going up every day. And that's where my interest in really got going in this whole idea of lean and collaboration. And that I hired about six more IORs and brought them into the sub meetings and said, so from now on, subs, you know, talk to your IOR before you install stuff. So we don't have to rip it out and inspect it again. So we sort of started that program, and people really appreciated that. And certainly general contractor appreciated it, because we were no longer getting stalled on, on delays because of it wasn't passing inspection. And then we created a small, very small, big room, but we brought the architects back in and started processing RFIs on the spot. And so we were able to recover about 6 months on that schedule.
Wow. So
that was my... that's all I'll say. I think that was the catalyst for me.
Yeah, you said you were wondering where I was going with that. That's exactly where I wanted to go. Because I think that is it's the aha moments in our community when people go, wow, we're not, as Will Lichtig says, hopeless victims of fate. You know, we can actually do things. And it's funny that it came in through the IOR. I remember working with LAUSD, and they were reluctant to hire inspectors of record. And I thought, this is exactly what we need here for the concrete mix and all the different things that we could make so many different mistakes on, that why wouldn't we want them on board to tell us exactly what they're going to accept? And it's funny that that crossed your path as well. And did you have any pushback that was an owner payment that you were paying for that? There's a lot of, back in the early days, lots of fights over who was going to pay for what, even if they were really good ideas.
Well, so far, pretty much I've learned the owner pays for everything. Just depends
at the end of the day.
So in this case, since, in this particular case, having a building be late by a year, that 6 months delta is really significant to revenue and patient care. So, at what point, I think it's getting better and better in our delivery models, but really the owner pays the costs. And if you don't, you just end up fighting about it. So, no, I didn't get any pushback on that. I got a little pushback on, at first, people saying, isn't that a conflict of interest? And so some of the hours were a little uncomfortable at first, but when we said, this is how you'll do it, I'm not going to do it for you, and then I'll come back, and if you've done it that way, we're done. And so people got then comfortable with the fact that it wasn't a conflict of interest.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So as you move through the San Jose portfolio and into the other kinds of projects, what were the size of the building program? I'm sure increased. And was part of your responsibility in hiring the architecture team that produced these things?
Yeah. So when I was in Northern California, it was four basic medical center campuses. Yeah, I was responsible for hiring architects and hiring contractors and then the whatever delivery model that we were going to use. So I got a lot of experience on what are owners sort of looking for in projects, and how do you think about what is it you're actually looking for when you hire an architect or a contractor? And actually, I got lucky to get, for some reason, I had a chance to do some things, I think mostly because people just weren't paying attention, which worked in my favor. So I started selecting subcontractors as well.
Oh, great.
In building teams rather than like having the whole team show up. And I got a chance to move away from hard bid and more into, which is now more, I guess, complex, and I see them at risk, but a lot of pre-con opportunities. So So again, I had an early opportunity here to start to see how you could start to form these teams and start thinking about collaboration from day one. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. I also admit I got a lot of experience, unfortunately, in mediation from some of the projects. Because some of those firebed jobs just didn't go well.
Right. It's funny. I was for a while, I was the chair of the California Dispute Resolution Council as a mediator, and by far construction was the largest client of that service. So you got through your mediation and you started moving into these larger projects. Were you still at Kaiser, or did you migrate out of Kaiser to another organization?
Well, I want to say a little bit more about Kaiser, actually, because I have to say that the foundation for me at Kaiser was really a spectacular opportunity as they say in management, you continue to get promoted to your highest level of incompetence. And so, I was following that ladder and had some luck about that. But at the latest point of my career, we created the National Facility Services. And so there were, at that time, I believe it was 8 regions. And my job was around project delivery modeling for the 8 regions. So I had a chance to create what then was called the Alliance Program, which was allowed us to, we hired select architects, a selection of builders and some major subcontractors, and then allowed them to form their own teams, others not, but we told them what projects they were going to likely get, so that, and they still had some level of competition, but the point was they had a long time before the project to start to think about how they do it, which then in the interviews got really interesting about what are some of the new ideas about, how they'd form a team, how they'd do the pre-construction. It really sort of, for me, was, again, without the name, it was a good introduction to some lean practices about being really much more efficient. And then as an owner, had a chance now to really start to explore. So I'm just not looking at a beauty contest set of presentations and PowerPoints but in fact, looking at how would you solve this problem? And the competition was then a little about how to solve that problem. So that was really successful. And that allowed, our savings, of course, was all around dollars. That was the big push for us. But for me, it was a pretty significant impact to the design construction industry.
The teams that were formed, were they integrated teams, or were the architects separate from the contractor, or did you tend to get a kind of design build influence there as you were going through those things?
We didn't use design build too much. We modified the CM at risk model. So we would hire the whole team day one.
Oh, good.
And then we tried to make designers builders and builders designers, and the engineers probably to be honest, I mean, everybody's really struggled with that, but it got better. It really got better when people realized that they weren't having to compete with each other, but in fact we're competing for the project, the outcome of the project. And so that was another area where I really had a chance to learn that it's not about the firms. Of course, it's about the people, but it's really about the focus of what is the owner trying to get done. And that really was an incredible learning experience for me, and still is today, in terms of getting teams to get past all that and just think about what are we really trying to accomplish here.
So that program was
pretty successful, but then Kaiser, I don't want to go too deep with that, but Kaiser decided to go a different direction, and so did I.
Yeah, it's funny. There were a number of projects that were being done at Disney in kind of an IPD way, and then they decided they wanted to go in a different direction. And UHS was very deeply into doing these projects, and then they made some decisions about, some guy comes in and says, "Hey, this is why are we being nice to these people?"
Yeah, exactly.
Were there people along the way that you met who were like-minded that that you recognize as, wow, these people really helped me out in my thinking around these things?
I'm sorry, can you try that again?
Yeah. So were the folks that you met along the way, like in my life, meeting Greg Howell was a real turning point for me because he was such a great storyteller around these things, and he was very thoughtful about, he'd ask more questions than he had answers, which was something I always loved about him. But were there mentors along the way that you found that were thinking about these same things, or at least co-conspirators, perhaps?
So I was in the right window for sure. People wanted to do something different. So using names, Peter Nosler of DPR.
Yep.
Got to know him from the, I got to know him when my son was like less than a month old, and he had just opened his business. And my wife said, you should meet this guy. And we became great friends. And he's clearly a divergent thinker. It's more, I think he's well known for that in terms of the whole idea of collaboration. So he was clearly one of my mentors, and he and I and a couple others created the Collaborative Process Institute, which was, we had lots of members for a long time and did a lot of conferences. But another one was a contractor, and Dave Higgins and HMH in his Sacramento firm. And he was one of the few contractors that actually, as he said it, I'll tell you where the pea is under the nut. So when they tell you this, this is what they mean. And when they tell you that, this is what they mean. Just a really honest guy and really taught me a great deal. And the quality of their work was really something. So he was a great mentor. And then, all along the way, I've had people who, have just been really instrumental in, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And so it's a long list of mentors. I've been very fortunate.
So at some point in time, you decided that we really need to consolidate some of these ideas. And did you take the Collaborative Construction Institute, move that into the Center for Innovation, or was that a different idea altogether?
Well, the timing is completely different. So what happened in the Collaborative Process Institute, I took that forward back into my work in Kaiser, and it actually became part of the foundation of the Alliance Program. So the timing is a little strange here, how this all works. But and so that, as that group, and I think at one time we were like 200 members or something like that.
Wow.
So that really helped. Well, by then I was doing a lot of presentations about this whole idea of, hiring everybody at the same time and different models like progressive hiring, like you hire the architect and together we hire the builder and then hire the builder, we hire the subs or vice versa. It didn't really matter. But as we built a team, we each participated in it. And so I started to give collaboration a different meaning because people were now, they didn't come with their team. And the reason we did that is because it allowed the owner to really also build the relationships with the individuals. And so that was one of the models that came out of all that. And we still use that today, that same model.
Interesting. So within the organization, as Kaiser changed directions and decided that they weren't enthralled with something that was actually doing them really well, I ran into this at the University of Chicago. We had been doing a lot of partnering there, but partnering in the sense not of relationships so much as knocking over the silos and really thinking about project delivery as a team sport, rather than all the individuals. And we'd increased client satisfaction at their projects from a baseline of 6 when we came in there to a baseline of around 9.5. And so their projects were producing, and then they got some bean counter from the University of Michigan and the whole staff was gone. And it was like, whoa, this is crazy. So Tell us about your ship.
I'm not sure if it's the same bean counter, but and I don't want to speak negatively of Kaiser. I really don't. It's just I was very proud of the system we built, and even people today are still saying, you know, that made a huge difference in the design and construction industry. And that's what I'm really proud of. It's not is you know, forget where it came from, but I think we did move the industry in a way that people said, you know, I'm not just designing buildings, I'm not just building buildings, but I'm really part of something bigger.
Right.
And one of the things that's most important to me, the reason why I'm in this business, is because I got it from my day at Kaiser's when I was programming those buildings, thinking once we build one of those buildings, like a medical office building, that's 40,000 members that now have more access to care.
Right.
One building. And so how, you know, where do you get a higher purpose than that?
Yeah.
And so then now if you can get the design industry, the engineers to think that same way, that's been my motivation all along.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I've so enjoyed working in healthcare. I remember I was working on a hospital at the University of Iowa, and they were slow, there were squabbles, or, you know, the drywaller wasn't performing, all kinds of things were happening. And this hospital meant that once this hospital opened, people in Iowa City didn't have to drive, you know, 160 miles to Des Moines to have a baby. And so we took the drywall team through the neonatal intensive care unit. And to watch those guys just melt and understand the importance of their work, we miss the target sometimes in healthcare, that these hospitals are really important to the communities and to the people that they serve, and the members of the Kaiser group of people that, you know, choose that kind of healthcare path. But in these smaller communities as well, they are just beacons for improving people's lives. And it's a great thing to be part of.
So once I really got into the Kaiser side, I of course was not practicing architecture, and although I'm licensed, but I haven't looked back.
Yeah.
Once in a while, I wonder what would have happened if I looked back, but
I don't think it's you've gone off and joined Stan Chu at one of the 13 architectural firms he's been with over time.
Yeah. But I don't have any reservations. It's been, it's really been great. And I think working now, because for Kaiser was the private side, so there were,
right,
things were a lot easier. And I'm on now on the public side. There's a lot more rules that I probably haven't done everything I needed to do to learn the rules. But it also opens some doors for me, which is because I think the public side, because it has rules, there's a general sort of a cloud over you can't do things. You know, there's too many laws, too many regulations. And I've been really successful. In my opinion, and others think so. For when we did the Mission Bay Hospital here at UCSF, I wasn't hired to do the hospitals. I was hired to manage design construction, smaller projects, and it just so happened that they wanted to start the new hospital in Mission Bay, and somehow Mark Larratt, who was the CEO, heard of me and asked me if I had hospital experience for $1 billion hospital. And I said something to the effect of, yeah, I think I have enough experience. If you add the ones together that I've done. And then he just said, so, you know, do you know the public system? And I said, no. I mean, I'd only been there like 3 months.
Right.
And, so he said, well, tell me how you would do this. And because, you know, it's more of a design build mentality at that time.
Right.
And so I said, well, what I would do is I'd do a modified seam at risk. Just everything we've already talked about, I'd bring everybody in at once. And we'd work, it's a 10-year project. And so he got his C-suite together. and asked me to make a presentation on how that would be different. And this is really ironic because I only had like three slides because the CFO had told me, you know, Mark is really fast and he'll understand right away. And so I had three slides. And after the first slide, he said, here, let me help you with your presentation. So, and Mark is just a wonderful, wonderful man. And so he just turned to the others and said, so what do you think of what he wants to do? And the comment was, well, it can't be any worse. So so I got a chance to introduce CMIT risk model what I would put into IPD, certainly not an IFA agreement, but in terms of integrated project delivery, it clearly was. And I was very excited about that. And we were extremely successful.
And what year was that about?
It was about 2010 it started.
So okay.
Recession, beginning of a big recession, but we had a budget of something, an estimate of about $1.8 billion, and we delivered that project at 1.5, including capitalized interest. So not just the dollar, but you're saying it was a huge success to that model. And so now that model is being used, and not just because of me, I'm just saying, I think
right.
It's been opening up now, and that's really great to see. So I'm really excited about that. And then in this case right now, I was able to introduce the IFOA here for the Parnassus job, which is, I think it's like the total package I said before, about $4.5 billion. The hospital itself is about almost $3 billion.
Wow.
We're literally, as you and I are talking right now, it's being passed around for signature. So I'm really excited to see the count and the amount by the end of the day for signatures. But
oh wow, that's fantastic! Yeah, good. Watch that DocuSign register go up, right? It's
exactly
banging away. So
it's very exciting, and the relationships you build in these things are great. But get back to what you're a little bit of your story. So when we did the Mission Bay Hospital project. It was clear to me that there were so many people involved in that project that I probably didn't have healthcare experience. So every month we did bring in practitioners and nurses and equipment people for these lunch and learns. And
right.
They'd be sponsored people to be, spend an hour and a half here at these lunches and learn. And it was incredible how people responded to that, saying, oh, and now I get really why I'm here. So that was really, and then one of my funnier stories for me, and it was another building which we didn't talk about was Precision Cancer Medicine Building, also at Mission Bay, which I did a couple years ago. And so then that one in the RFQ going out to hire architects and builders, one of the questions was, what can you do to cure cancer? And people weren't expecting a question like that, like. I thought I was going to tell you about my team, and you want to know I'm not a doctor. And I said, I know you're not a doctor, but why do you want to do this project? What is it? How do you relate to that? What's your empathy in this healthcare? And that had tremendous influence, just tremendous. The people really during that time, and we literally went out with the workers and laborers and talked about this, and they really got into their stories about their families and. And that building was an incredible success. Just more than just the design and the construction. I mean, the quality of the people's purpose was just. And so that's kind of where I'm at now, is this whole idea of purpose.
I think it's, Daniel Pink talks about motivation as being intrinsic motivation, that you don't really motivate people with money. You kind of have to take money off the table. But if you can give somebody work for which they have, substantial autonomy, where they feel like they have achieved mastery around some of these things, and they can look back at the end of the day and actually see that they've made progress. That's what really drives people forward. And I think in these hospital projects that have been really successful, like Parkland was a very successful hospital project in Dallas, mm-hmm. and that was CMIT risk with a quarterly kind of review by the owner, whether the owner felt respect it or not. It's just kind of, it mimicked, I think, what they did at the Pentagon. And it was one of those hospitals where, you know, even with a 6-month delay, based on the challenge by the U.S. Department of Health on Parkland's delivery of emergency care, when Parkland was delivering, you know, they were delivering like 1% of the babies in the world. They were dealing with, 0.5% of gunshot triages in the country. It was just an amazing thing that the Department of Health would get in there and say, I'm not sure you guys know how to do this. But it was a great project to work on. And like you say, you look back with pride on those things of, you know, that you really helps motivate that. So somewhere along the line, the Center for Innovation came in, because I remember I took over LCI in 2010, and I got invited to a meeting in Howard's office about the Center for Innovation as you guys were kicking that off. And what was the genesis of that? Because that's playing a very important part now in this whole Ukrainian thing.
Yeah. So, well, again, apologies, because I think that's where we first met, and I didn't recall, but I'm glad you reminded me, however. But the without going too far back in time, so after I left Kaiser and before I started UCSF, I was just consulting for a while, and the AIA, Northern California chapter, asked me to chair a definitions committee around IPD to define it. So if you look in the AIA documents 300 years ago, you'll see a document that I chaired in. But it really started to put out the tenets and describe what IPD could be. And that was under another umbrella of sort of I'm not going to call it a position within AIA, because they never paid me for anything like that. But when I finished that, they said, so what do you wish we do next? And, I remember, sitting at the table saying, one of the things we've learned in this whole IPD thing is innovation. And as an owner, I have lots of thoughts about innovation, in that instead of it being a marketing material, let's turn it into, let's make it available to people so that it isn't just marketing, but in fact, let's find out who really does know how to do this. I mean, I remember as an owner being interviewed, and especially like they did the laser, above ceiling laser,
scanning or whatever.
And what was really interesting is some of these firms would say, this, we do this on every project, and we invented this. And then the next interview team would come along and they say, they same exact pictures. Okay, I'm not sure what the truth of this is. But that wasn't my issue. My issue was, why are we making every project its own unique innovation? Why are we creating a platform for innovation? So that was my goal. And so I was the original founder. And again, that was the idea. And then it took us a long time then to get clear on our mission, our purpose. And, in some ways, everybody saying, well, what is innovation? And so it took us a long time to really define it and get people to really get engaged in it. But once we did, I think it's really taken off. I think we have like 800 or so followers, something like that. And actually have a couple thousand followers, but 800 who are really keep track of us is pretty. And we're building, and we've got a great board now. Every year our board gets stronger and stronger. But, what we're really trying to do is just be a catalyst for divergent thinking. We don't market with anybody. We don't do our own innovations in that sense. And if we do, we certainly talk about it. But it's really about connecting people and inspiring people to think differently and to ask the questions. And so I think we were being, we could just continue to get more people interested about, how do we think more in a more divergent way? How do we learn? How do we start to learn about that? So You know, we do have these sessions where we bring people in and can learn from facilitators about how to think about innovation in their own work, and they come up with their own problem and they start to think that through. And some of our sponsors have spent people there to, and it's been really successful.
Yeah.
And again, and the idea of what's really interesting in that innovation thing, it's not just about materials, it's not just about design, it's not just about construction. But it's, for example, like in the Ukraine. So, you know, how can Ukraine rebuild? So we've been talking right. with them, and they've been talking with us about how do we do things that's not, they don't want us to, at least the part we're engaged in, they don't want us to do it for them. They want to know what are some things we've learned in our lean processes that can help them to build, rebuild in a quicker way. I'm not going to have the right terms for that, but in a way to organize a program to be the most efficient and have the highest value for as they start to rebuild and repair. So we're really excited about that link right now with Ukraine and as part of the extension of the Center for Innovation.
Yeah, I think it's phenomenal because I think that, you know, most of us in the community have thought about things like, you know, the terrible side of this is the opportunity it does give us to showcase some of the things we've learned over the years in terms of rapid recovery. And I like to think of it as more effectiveness than efficiency. You know, how are you effective and sustainable, and not just sustainable environmentally, but sustainable in terms of how do you create a building industry within Ukraine that can respond to not just war, but the vagaries of a transient population coming back, coming forth, you know, this nationalism that will, of course, have been sparked by their tremendous heroism in the face of what they have been fighting. And so I was really intrigued when Dean Reed called me and said, hey, we need you guys to help us out. So I want to put a pitch out to the podcast listeners that they can contact the Center for Innovation to help with. I know that there's fundraising parts to bring the Ukrainians here and to send folks over there. But you've got quite a cast of characters in the Bay Area, from Stanford University academics to University of California at Berkeley academics, people who have been, you know, in the industry like Dean, doing really great stuff. Why don't you say a little bit about that so that we can shamelessly put a plug here?
A little bit more about Dean, or
no, a little more about your Dean's project.
But so what we're doing right now is we're actually just starting to organize. For example, as you mentioned, getting them introduced to Stanford and SIFI and some of the leaders there. But, you know, really that, and I think I liked your word in terms of, but how are they thinking about the building industry, particularly the industrialized and just process? What's going on in the Berkeley is still being formed as to how it might link to P2SL and some other things. And then on, I know we're bringing them here to our Parnassus project to see how the big room is working, and also the technologies that we're starting to use with, we're not using AI yet, but we're using all of the virtual realities that we can design a lot just virtually here. So we're using some of those tools. So we're taking them through, and now that's the whole idea is to go through, and there's some other projects like in Davis. So we want to just give them, first of all, we're responding to their questions.
Right.
So, and we're still working on that list of questions, but our goal is not to, at all to say, hey, this is what you should be doing. Our goal is if you've asked us that question, excuse me, let's expose you to, you know, how we're trying to think about that. So right. those are the big things. So it'll be processed for sure. I think industrialized, however you want to call it, construction, certainly we get into pods and whole building types of industrialized construction. And again, I think we really want to introduce as many people with experience with, just as you described, it's not just the design construction process, but you know, how do you start to deal with all of the pieces here that have to be brought together? I mean, Bill coming back to a place that it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
You know, and how do you get, you know, people then, you know, inspired and motivated and help to heal that? Because it's really part of the whole process as well.
For sure.
I can give you the plug that we're working on it. I can give you the plug to go to CFI and we'll continue, because we are working on this like every several days a week as to how this program is and to get it established. It's not fully baked yet, but we're definitely looking for sponsors. If there's anyone interested at all, please go to CFI, or you can call me directly. And I can link you, guarantee you, I can link you to the movement. Right. And we're not just looking for money. We are looking for money, but we're also looking for people who have an interest in this. So,
yeah, I'm sure there's a very big pool of people out there that would like to help. I've reached out to some people in Toronto and Ottawa here in Canada, and largely people from the Ukrainian community, but they're also builders. So it's a perfect kind of a perfect fit for that. So that's great. So congratulations on at least on doing that work. But let's talk about Parnassus for a bit, because I think, you know, when we talk about great projects that we've had in the States, there's it starts and stops with Cathedral Hill as a, you know, one of the big massive projects that was a big lean one. I think Penn Health just opened up their new Norman Foster Hospital to great success, especially in terms of patient ratings. I think their rating went from, you know, 82% to 98% month on month after they opened that place. And Parnassus is something people have been looking at for a long time, going, wow, that's a really interesting design coming out of that grove and that mountain and that pagoda and all of all the rest of the stuff that you deal with. So tell us a little bit about that project.
Sure. So, I think I'll just start. Basically, so Parnassus hasn't had much attention for a long time. When we built Mission Bay first, it was just to be able to offload some of the density at Parnassus so that we could, you know, get some breathing room to be able to do some more work at Parnassus. So that was the first set of moves. And so that really helped us. And then clearly, you know, we just need a lot more beds. We need to almost double our beds at Parnassus. So the only way to do that then is on that site, which is only, I believe, 4.5 acres. So we have to demolish an inpatient site building. So we have to build a whole new inpatient site service over at Mount Zion. So that's sort of the steps. But I'm going to go back to then. So when we started talking about, of course, this is multi-billions dollars, what's going to be the delivery method that we want to use? And that's where I was really just really lucky to get convinced the Regents that we should try the IFOA, because of the incentive programs that are, it's not the programs, but it's the incentive system it sets up for success for the owner as well as for the builders. And so, because the project is so big, all of these subcontractors, I mean, their contracts are as much as whole buildings. So, so we were able then to get the IFOA, which we think was really, it's an important step, because I think we wanted to be sure that we had around the table all people had a chance, including the owner, to have open conversations about what were issues, what concerns, what are risks. And, you know, typically it's all under one general contractor.
Right.
And not that that's a bad thing, but on a project this big, I really wanted to open it up around the table to say everybody has a voice. So we're doing a polyform.
Good. Okay.
So
I think what's really important about it is it does build in the right incentives, but even greater than that, it has contract alignment so that everybody is under the same vehicle. Everybody swims and sinks, you know, pretty much at the same level.
Well, that's what I saw when I talk about incentives. It's not dollar incentive, it's incentives to really work together. And that and that's where we're trying very hard at the same time, is what are we working together for? What are we really trying to do? And so some people will say this is really a play on words, but it's really not. And at least for us, it's the guiding light, which is you have to mix a couple of things that we're designing and building the building within our concept is healing habitat. So we're thinking about this just not as a hospital, but in place. In fact, it's a habitat, which has a much bigger meaning. So it's really a place. And now it's a place for what? So here's where you were going to experience patient care in lots of different sensories. So the design really will be a lot of nature with outside the building, inside the building. A lot of different emphasis now on food, so that, you know, food courts are not just fast places. They're in fact, I'm not going to say they're restaurants, but, you know, it's much more focused on much higher quality food. Right. We have extensive gardens along the higher podiums and other places. So we have views in the entire, you can't see Sacramento, but close. The views are just phenomenal. So we're using that as part of the healing process as well. In terms of color, light, sensory, we're trying to stimulate all of those things, not just for the patient, but for the visitors, for the staff. So there's a lot of emphasis in our design decisions about how does this design decision affect the senses of the sensory of health.
Wow. So there's almost a perfect circle from your original research to the, I'm assuming this is kind of your imprimatur. You're not planning on doing six more Parnassuses in your career.
No, not more than three. No, I think this is it. But I said earlier, when I did my thesis, we had incandescent light. So you had to use, red light, green light, blue light, white light to make colors. But now LED, you can do it all in one controller. I'm excited about some of the things that we're talking about doing as to, how, I don't know that we'll get there, but I'm hopeful that the patient can control the colors or the in one way, because it people they respond, their health responds differently to a red light, blue light in terms of calmness and anxieties. So I'm really excited about that, but that's just one piece. But my point is, it's all of those kinds of sensory pieces that make this a place, not just another hospital. We're working very hard to define that. And that's why I really like having our 13 partners thinking each individually about this. So that it's a challenge for sure. But in a good way. I mean, I'm really excited about the people who are on this project.
That's fantastic. So. Well, hopefully it'll be a great success. I know everybody in the community is pulling for it. When you mentioned Parnassus, people just go, man, it takes their breath away. So congratulations on doing that.
Thank you. No, we've been, we have, Herzog de Meuron, which is a really interesting design group. I think they have really caught on to this whole concept of, architecture is part of the healing process. And so that's really very exciting. And I think HDR is doing a great job. If I call it everybody, I'll take for the rest of the time. But my point is that some of these firms have never done IFOA.
Yep.
And several have. So that blending is we're still working with it, but it's really getting stronger and stronger. So it's really exciting.
Yeah, no, it sounds very exciting. It's as I, climb the last steps of my career as well. I look at some of the projects that I've been in, I had the great privilege to work on, and it's been great being part of the community. So thank you for all your efforts there, my friend.
Well,
good work.
As I said, I think much earlier, I'm really very privileged that I've had, the experiences that I've had and been asked to participate in. It's unbelievable. Long ways away from that drafting board, but
we're very privileged to have stolen an hour or more of your time. So thank you so much for taking the time to hang out. It's been great.
Well, Nick, you're more than welcome. I appreciate this opportunity as well. Just to be honest, having a chance to tell my story has just been really exciting for me. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.